Apple cider vinegar and ice cream in the 90s? I don't think so.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
More Like Ancient Phalians.
This is More Like Ancient Phalians, a podcast about the only show that is willing to ask the stupid questions, Ancient Aliens. I'm Toby Ball, the creator and host of the UFO podcast, Strange Arrivals.
And I'm Brandon R. Reynolds, someone who's not impressed by skinwalkers because he's been walking around in his own skin for at least 5 years.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
Thank you.
So we are very happy to have with us today Erica Lukes. Erica is a UFO historian, archivist, and researcher, and the executive director of the Expanding Frontiers Research Organization. Erica, welcome.
Thank you. I am excited to be here tonight.
Yeah, this is going to be fun.
And I love your show.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, this is going to be a fun conversation. Erica knows as much about Skinwalker Ranch as anybody, so prepare to learn.
Possibly more than the Skinwalker people themselves do.
I would assume so.
I might agree with you.
All right, so today we're looking at Season 15, Episode 10, The Mystery of Skinwalker Ranch. It originally aired March 28th, 2020. Not too surprisingly, not a whole hell of a lot was going on this date because essentially the entire world was dealing with COVID. Yet somehow the Yemenis still managed to be having a civil war, but that's about it. So moving right along, why are we covering this episode? That is a good question. One of the reasons, I guess, is that it's kind of a chance to get to know some of the UFO people in the History Channel world who are outside the ancient astronaut theorists. That's the best I could come up with.
Kind of they're expanding the History Channel cinematic universe with some spinoffs.
Yeah, I think so. It's not, but it's a pretty loose spinoff. There's not a whole lot of crossover, which brings us to the thesis of this episode, which is, in my estimation, we have this other show on our channel that we'd like you to check out at some point.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I think that about covers it. So let's get underway. They do their usual preview, which is always kind of wild. The thing that stuck out to me is that they said that some people think the Skinwalker Ranch is evil, which is a little strange. Made me wonder if all 512 acres were evil, or just some parts of it are evil. How is a place evil? Lots of sort of existential questions occurred to me on this.
You know, I mean, there are lots of things that they say about this ranch, and they've yet to prove any of them. You know, it's a good story. It makes for good TV. But again, I've never really known anybody that has been on the ranch that can substantiate any of the claims they've made about evil doing or about the detrimental effects of being on the ranch and leaving the ranch or having hitchhikers follow them home. So, you know, you put a lot out there, and at the end of the day, you know, the onus is on you to either provide the evidence or to keep the myth-making alive.
I would say they're keeping the myth-making alive with desperate energy. They briefly mentioned that the Utes say there is a dark presence there. Sure, that sounds good. So the first part of this episode basically seems to be sort of giving a synopsis for the uninitiated about what Skinwalker Ranch actually is. And you meet some of the main guys. It's not entirely clear that all of them are main guys while you meet them, but these are them. We start off with Travis Taylor. He has a PhD from University of Alabama, Huntsville, famous for having a Division I hockey team in Alabama for some reason. He worked for the Department of Defense and NASA. He was the star of National Geographic Channel's Rocket City Rednecks, which aired from 2011 to 2013. He's written 14 sci-fi novels, which is pretty impressive. That's a lot of writing. And he's one of the stars of The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch. And he's also been on Ancient Aliens and other paranormal shows. Erica, do you know Travis Taylor?
I did meet Travis at a conference. And so I had a brief moment to ask him about the dangerous levels of radiation that were at the ranch and that they like to promote. And I asked them if that was the case and people were being harmed, what steps have they taken to ensure the public safety? And his reply to me was, well, that's what the TV show is for.
To provide protection from dangerous levels of radiation?
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a hell of a cliffhanger.
Yes, yeah. It was. That's my one interaction with him.
He reminds me of, when you think about the sci-fi writers of yore, like who were writing for the pulps, Isaac Asimov and L. Ron Hubbard and all those folks from back in the day where they were just making their nut, writing crazy stories. And then some of them got taken more seriously. And some, who shall remain nameless, started religions off of that. But it does sort of seem like the guy wrote a bunch of sci-fi novels, and then all of a sudden he's now a serious investigator of these things. I think we've been down this road before. And it's really interesting because I assume that you get a fan base right from the novels, especially if you're doing stuff that's in the realm of popular paranormal things. People start to come approach you and say, do you believe this stuff? What do you know? You know, et cetera. And I guess at some point you're like, what the hell? I'm just going to take it seriously and enroll very neatly into a career from science fiction to science pseudo fact kind of stuff. And I think that's a pretty good career trajectory.
And he's got some bona fides, right? I mean, he's got a PhD from UA Huntsville. Huntsville is a NASA town. And I guess he's just the star of this Rocket City Rednecks, which probably gave him a taste of the good life. All right, so we'll move on to Jeremy Corbell, who is one of the most ubiquitous of the UFO celebrities, I would say. So he actually did some kind of interesting art in the early 2000s, which I was kind of surprised to see. I mean, it wasn't ridiculous. He could have stayed with that. On his Wikipedia page, it has this excellent two sentences where it says, Corbell is a black belt in traditional jujitsu and is the creator of, in quotes, quantum jujitsu.
Oh.
Yeah.
End quote, which sounds like a massive pile of bullshit.
It just means you don't know where his foot is at any given
exactly.
time. You can know its position, but not its trajectory. You can know its trajectory, but not its position.
That's very Heisenbergian of you.
But
quantum jujitsu, what is it? It's ridiculous. Anyway, in 2001, he self-published his first book, Radiant Source, Cultivating Warrior Consciousness, about his philosophy of martial arts, including presumably quantum jujitsu. He has been involved in the release of some of the UFO films that came out of the To the Stars Academy. He is constantly in my Twitter feed saying that there's stuff that you wouldn't believe that's about to come down the pike and just hang in there, and then assumes that you've forgotten that in 2 weeks because there's another cool thing coming down the pike that also doesn't arrive. Erica, so I assume you must have run into Jeremy.
Yeah, I spoke at a conference with him, and he is a very larger-than-life person that seems to be there and puts himself in the center of a lot of events.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, and he seems like he's hooked up with Lou Elizondo, who does not appear in this, but it seems like he and Lou Elizondo are sort of together quite a bit.
Yeah, right, and George Knapp. I mean, they're one and the same, so in my opinion. But I mean, he's done, like you said, he's had an interesting career. His art career early on was very interesting. And he is a, you know, like I said, when you see him, he's a larger-than-life guy who's very good on camera and very good at creating these moments. In the next 2 weeks, in the next 2 years, we're going to have disclosure and all of these things that never come. But he has a huge following that clearly likes that dangling carrot type of approach.
Could you get the sense when you deal with these folks that they're always performing? I mean, when you're talking to them, do they seem genuine or do they seem like they're selling something? I mean, how natural is their presence or how supernatural?
You know, I think, you know, 80% of the people that do this really believe in they've either had experiences or that there's something to it. But then you get the upper echelon who they are on the speaking, you know, tour, and they do make money. They sell books, and they are, in my opinion, grifting and running with stories that they can spend a whole career promoting that aren't verifiable, you know. And to me, that's a problem because I like to have integrity, and I think this is a really fascinating subject that deserves to be studied without all of this garbage kind of interspersed, you know, in between all of it. So
Corbell seems sort of Joe Rogan adjacent in my mind, and he must have been on Joe Rogan.
He's been on a couple of times.
because he's, you know, the martial arts and all this stuff and the UFOs and the quantum stuff. But his art was, I thought his art was kind of cool, actually. All right. And then we get George Knapp, who's an interesting character. So I'd obviously heard of him before, but when I was doing Strange Arrivals and I was doing a little bit about Area 51, and I found sort of the original videos of George Knapp when he was a Las Vegas local TV news reporter. Mm-hmm. And he's reporting on Area 51 before Area 51 became, you know, Area 51 in caps that everybody knows about. And it was kind of cool to see. Like, it didn't make me think that there was necessarily anything there, but it was kind of interesting as a piece of sort of like UFO history to see, like, oh, so this is where it all started with this guy's like news report. And I could see just watching it, and you're watching the local news, you're not expecting sort of that kind of paranormal stuff to pop up in like a real like investigative report. And there it is. But he's worked that report into quite a career in the UFO field. He is a host of Coast to Coast AM. He's won a bunch of journalism awards. He is the guy who brought Bob Lazar to the public's attention. He married his longtime girlfriend, Anne the Viking Fechner, in 2010. So that was a nice little factoid.
Sweet.
Yeah. The Viking. Brandon, you know, you've run across George Knapp, have you not?
Yeah, as a journalism adjacent guy, he definitely was sort of like Linda Moulton Howe. They're great on TV because they'll go through what seems like a process. Like, well, first I did this, and then I talked to these people, you know, and it's very journalism flavored content, but then there's a lot of credulity to it over the kind of course of their career. And like Erica said, they get the feedback loop of people being like, this is important work you're doing, you better keep doing it. And then they do. They're very happy to do it rather than at some point going, this might be horse shit. I think there's an interesting tradition of like local journalists who stumble into something and, you know, it's just as there's some of it that's opportunist. Like it's obviously not necessarily a critique of people who spin off and do other things. Like you can go from being a sci-fi writer to being a proponent of this stuff. You can go from being a journalist to getting into this world. So, you know, it's not in and of itself the worst thing ever. But yeah, I think you carry that sort of gravitas with you, like I have right now. You know, I sound very serious, and you'll believe what I say. And when I'm going to sell you, I'm doing a martial arts style that is quantum kung fu, which, yes, is a little different than jiu-jitsu. It's more kicking, yep, and less wrestling.
I'm sure, but it's more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you never know. You're both being grabbed and not grabbed at the same time.
That's the way I like it.
Erica. Toby's like, please, Brandon, stop talking.
I don't even want to think about this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you don't. That's what makes it dangerous, Toby. A dangerous martial art. Please, Erica, talk.
Well, I think I'm just flabbergasted after that. It's going to take me a second to process everything you just said. So
it happens. It nappens.
As Erica thinks, I will say that one of the things about George Knapp, and I can't remember who the other guys were who were co-authors of Skinwalkers at the Pentagon.
Oh, James Letatsky and Colm Kelleher.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that was going to like sort of show, you know, the secret Pentagon work on UFOs. And I believe it's the first chapter is about how some guy who'd been at the Skinwalker Ranch goes back to his home in McLean, Virginia. And there's a giant wolf that stands on its hind legs that's like hanging out in the woods behind his house, and his kids see it and stuff. And at that point, I was like, I don't know if I can, like, if you're really trying to write an expose that people are supposed to take seriously about UFO investigations in the Pentagon, and you're starting off with giant wolves walking around your property in McLean, Virginia on their hind legs, like, you've lost me. I lived in the DC area for 8 years. I never saw one wolf walking around on their hind legs.
Well, I mean, you would kind of think, but again, people like love this. They buy it. I mean, luckily not a lot of people, but you know, there are people that are just mesmerized with the wolves walking on hind legs. And I've really tried to figure out why people go down these rabbit holes. And I've gone down a couple rabbit holes myself, but I've known better and I pulled myself back and hopefully try to teach people how to use critical thinking. I don't know. It's a shock.
Yeah. Good luck. Good luck with that. So we kind of meet these people. Jeremy Corbell sets out the quote fact that Skinwalker Ranch is the, again, quote, most scientifically studied
UFO or paranormal hotspot in history.
I'm willing to believe that. I believe that they've done a lot of studying. I don't know that it means very much.
Well, let me just tell you, honestly, having interviewed the people from the Bigelow days and having seen what they're doing now, there was never a serious study at the ranch. And this is according to the people that were working for Bigelow. Bigelow would not allow them to take the equipment that they had at headquarters in Vegas and take it to the ranch. The cameras that were set up on the ranch, half of them were dummy cameras, so they weren't even functional. I mean, it was really one of the shoddiest things I'd ever seen. You know, and then they've got the armed security guards for whatever that's worth, so somebody doesn't step over their 3-foot fence. I mean, it's like every story that they've put forward, like we can't drill on the property. In the photos I have from when Bigelow was there, there was a huge tractor, a huge backhoe on the property. So they were drilling. The interesting thing about it is the people that owned the ranch before Bigelow bought it still own the mineral rights. And there are huge oil reserves around the whole area. So all of these things that have been not, I can't even say carefully crafted, but have been put forward to the public are just complete rubbish.
Why wouldn't Bigelow let them take the equipment that he had in Vegas out to the ranch?
Well, yeah, Pre was probably frightened that they wouldn't find anything.
Oh, well, there's that.
And, I mean, it was really seeing the photos, and I have been to the ranch. I've been on the ranch in the newer days, but you had an aquarium on top of a light pole with little kids' toys in it, because that was how they were going to communicate. Mm. You just think, did a 5-year-old come up with this? You know, I mean, none of it. If you're really serious about doing a scientific study, I mean, this is not it. And also, you know, it's the most guarded secret on the planet with all of these evil things taking place. And yet you can literally, like I was saying, you can walk over the fence.
Huh.
It abuts all different properties that are owned by people. It's just none of it makes any sense other than the fact that people have created this area to profit off of the story of the ranch.
It feels to me like in the UFO world, like there's this sort of like science adjacent activity that goes on where it's you go through the motions of doing science, but without actually doing science, so that you can sort of make claims about things, but it's not actually using the scientific method or actually any kind of method that makes any sense, hence aquariums with kids' toys on light poles. I can't remember if it was this or in another one where they're talking about how so many people have made claims and like that in and of itself is evidence. It's like, no, that's absolutely not evidence. It's like, those are claims. That's not evidence in the slightest.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Well.
You know, one of the mysteries of this episode and other episodes, but particularly this one is, you know, Bigelow is this mythic character. And I swear to God, when you see him, it's like, oh, there is just a physical type. He's a little bit Disney. He's a little bit Tony Stark. They always have the little mustache, mm-hmm. You know, he's a little bit Howard Hughes. I mean, in the Vegas thing, particularly, like they cast themselves in this way as, you know, I have got this great fortune and I'm going to dedicate it to some sort of solving something. I mean, at least with Howard Hughes, he really was like accomplishing some things in science and entertainment. But then Bigelow, I mean, the show doesn't do anything to make his motivations less obscure other than like he wanted to do this stuff. And then he sold and, you know, the show bends over backwards to try and convince you that like something about it had freaked him out and maybe he found all this stuff, but he sure wasn't sharing it. And it's the only time that we've encountered in this program heretofore where Giorgio Tsoukalos actually allows for the possibility that he doesn't have anything.
Okay, either he's not saying anything because it's so incredible or because there's nothing there. Which one is it?
And I'm like, if Giorgio Tsoukalos says you might not have something, that is the worst of evidence. Because he allows for anything, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Good for him.
Yeah.
Like him a little bit more now.
Yeah, it was almost like he felt a little threatened by the presence of this other program coming at him. And he's like, I'm going to be the adult in the room. Have to really be the objective one here. So I'm going to say, maybe there's nothing there. We're doing this out of a contractual obligation to the History Channel. But Erica, what do you think about Bigelow? Give us your take on his psychology, sociology, psychic
Lord,
state.
Have mercy. And let me hire a bodyguard. I think that, you know, he is like this little mythic creature that's created this narrative and kind of the slick Las Vegas type and a budget suites. You know, he made his money from budget suites. He has low income motels and he's an interesting fellow. You know, I can really picture both he and George Knapp sitting at the back of the Tropicana waiting for the hair club for men meeting and getting ready to roll. Who's got the best plastic surgeon? I don't know. Let's get Linda in here. I'm just kidding about that. But it's so contrived. To me, there's nothing genuine. And that's what really bothers me about his Inception, you know, story about how he got involved in this. It's like, and the story changes. From what I understand, he sold the property because the property's not worth anything. I mean, he did do a great deal if he bought it for, what, $280,000. And then sold it for $2 million, whatever the story is. You know, I mean, he made a great deal of money on that real estate exchange, but it's just nothing is genuine. Even on 60 Minutes, it's, you know, I've got more evidence and they're right underneath our noses. But yet you've done nothing in your whole 50 years to put forward the evidence that you have. And you've used the government to get a $22 million contract for what? So there's so many questions that I have. And again, I go back to the fact that if this place is really, truly paranormal, if it was top secret, then you can be sure that you wouldn't have seen it pop up in magazines where they were advertising the location during this alleged top secret government program where there are portals and mythical beings are popping in and out of. I mean, all of it, like when you really sit back and look at it, it's just so ridiculous. So in my opinion, there's something else obviously going on behind the scenes. I'm not quite sure what, and probably don't want to know, but it's very disingenuous.
Well, you know, it's interesting you point out the $22 million, which is what the government gave them to apparently research things for ATIP. And in previous episodes, we've talked about that particular funding. And Toby has pointed out that, you know, if the government really wanted to invest in research for something, $22 million is not a lot of money. You know, I mean, spacecraft that NASA sends off, those can be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So you say, well, $22 million. But on the other hand, if you're not doing anything and you just want to swallow some money, $22 million is a pretty good payday to, you know, run around and install non-working aquaria and non-working cameras. Like, you know, somebody did all right on that deal.
Exactly.
And is there any clarity about what any of that money went to?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, some papers that were written that, you know, I mean, if that's what you get for $22 million, and I think you bring up a really good point. I mean, it's like the guy made bank. You know, there's no equipment. You know, there's no research. That was a good deal there for him.
And we paid for it, Toby.
Yeah.
All right. Suklos shows up at the end of this little segment and describes Skinwalker as the Disneyland of the paranormal, which sounds about right. Was it Bigelow who started calling it Skinwalker Ranch, or had it always been called Skinwalker Ranch? Do you know?
You know what? I think that was probably something that Knapp and Kelleher came up with.
Okay. Because it seems to me that in some ways, like, that's just like the crucial piece of the whole thing, is they came up with a cool, creepy name for it.
Skinwalker Ranch.
Skinwalker Ranch.
Skinwalker Ranch.
Right.
And then everything else can kind of flow from that.
You know, and I just have to say that I've interviewed and knew someone that was one of the world's foremost Native American historians, Dr. Floyd O'Neill. And he grew up in this area. And he went around and collected and documented all the oral histories from every Native American tribe. And I asked him on numerous occasions, well, what about the Skinwalkers? he looked at me like I was absolutely insane. First of all, that area, the Navajo, were not there. The Skinwalker myth or the story is not even a part of that area, you know? And so it's just so, it's so preposterous and kind of insulting, you know, to have people make up that story and then insert this Skinwalker lore from the Navajo. And you know, I mean, it just is very interesting. But yeah, the people that I have spoken with who are the experts in the field who have been there, even Dr. Frank Salisbury, who was very popular in the UFO world, who helped Junior Hicks write the Utah UFO display. When I spoke with him before he passed away, he said to me that he felt that Skinwalker Ranch was completely made up by George Knapp, you know? And so it's, again, you can pick and choose all of these things. You can go out in rural Utah and find a spooky ranch, and you can create all sorts of great ghost stories with a little bit of lore. And, you know, that is to me what they've done quite brilliantly, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real grab bag of stuff you have. As Toby pointed out, giant werewolves, which they think are direwolves, which of course come from the past, supposedly. All the weird lights, poltergeists. I mean, it's just everything. Everything is going on there. And then the show, which, you know, it does as well as can be expected, is like, now we're going to connect all of this string for you in a way that will make you feel only a little psychotic by the end of the episode. But usually they're a little more focused. Like, this place does this one thing. It's UFOs, yeah. Or, you know, it's pyramids that conduct energy or whatever it is. But this is like, man, whatever you want, we got it. You want wolves? We got wolves.
I mean, one of the things that makes this so weird is that there's usually sort of this like ADHD aspect to Ancient Aliens, where you're just like every 5 minutes you're going to some new place and some new thing. And so the idea of actually spending, you know, the full like 45 minutes in one spot for the most part is, it's a little bit jarring when you're used to the quick yeah. flipping around. There is like this sort of half-hearted attempt to kind of connect it to ancient astronaut theory type stuff. We get a Navajo Nation ranger named Jonathan Dover, who says that skinwalkers are nothing to be trifled with, and that even talking about them is putting him in particular in danger.
The skinwalker is somebody who is evil.
Jim Morse, who is the Skinwalker Ranch manager, says that the Utes are afraid of the area. And they also kind of get into this whole thing about in January 1864, the Utes, the Navajo, and the U.S. Army were fighting over some territory in Utah.
Nowhere near the ranch, by the way.
Nowhere near the ranch. Well, of course not. Navajo were forced out, and leading to the Long Walk. And then apparently they cursed the Utes. And then the question comes up a little bit later. Were skinwalkers conjured by Navajos, or are they paranormal? Because those are really the only two possibilities that we're left with.
Oh, yeah.
Are they paranormal or just Navajo conjured beasts?
And is a Navajo conjured beast not paranormal?
No, I thought,
wait a minute. That seems pretty fucking paranormal to me. Also like that they, you know, the ones who, Erica, this kind of speaks to what you're saying about the ones who are the real grifters. The way they use language, I've become such a fan of, you know, there's always the, you have to wonder.
You have to wonder.
But Nick Redfern comes in and there's just things that they, you know, they're like making a point, but then there's so many things that they imply and you just go, yeah, that makes sense. And it was Redfern talking about the skinwalker, describing it. And he says, it's sort of typically 6 to 7 feet tall. Sort of, you know, if you're looking at, like, if you go to the Smithsonian and you see one, that's kind of the range you're going to see of the skinwalker. Sort of typically 6 to 7 feet. Sometimes there's taller ones. Every now and again, you'll see a shorter one. But, you know, in general, you go out.
Well, those are adults, too.
Yeah.
Younger skinwalkers are smaller.
Sort of typically, Toby.
They grow, yeah. Children can be 2 to 3 feet tall.
Based on what?
Anyway. Yeah.
But I did go, when he said that, I was like, I mean, I really found myself like an idiot, like kind of shrugging, be like, oh, that makes sense. You know, seven, I mean, that's pretty good size for skinwalker. Yeah. Like, no, God damn it. That's, no. Continue, please.
All right. So now we get to kind of the bulk of the episode, which is recent Skinwalker Ranch history. And it's basically essentially a bunch of stories that don't really have any evidence to them, or in a lot of cases are surprisingly uncreepy. So we're introduced to the Shermans, who were the owners before Robert Bigelow. George Knapp, for some reason, tells some story about a big grizzled guy who came to Skinwalker Ranch to meditate.
Oh, yeah.
And a creature that looked like he was wearing the camouflage from the movie Predator.
With the camouflage, the opaque camouflage, the invisibility technology, this thing comes right up to this guy and roars. Scares the hell out of this guy, who opens his eyes, flies back, lands on his back.
And then this big grizzly meditation guy just leaves.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
Toby, you know how tall the big grizzled guy was?
The guy, he was probably like 6'7". 6'7". Sort of mid-range.
Yeah. He was sort of typically 6-7 feet.
Yeah, something like that. Tom Winterton says he got a head injury that causes his head to swell. And the question is did that come from digging at Skinwalker Ranch? I don't know. Maybe, but probably not.
But I will definitely tell you the medical professionals I've had look at his head bandage were in a little bit of shock and awe about the type of ACE bandage dressing they would use to help that injury. I'm just saying.
You're just saying that his dressing was not medically accurate?
I'm thinking there was a little something shady about it, but...
All right. We meet Bryant the Dragon Arnold. Security are heavily armed, although later we will hear that, in fact, bullets don't really hurt the Skinwalker, so being heavily armed seems kind of beside the point. You can watch The Thing with Kurt Russell to see how that works out. In the mid-90s... The Shermans, this is quite something. They've been at Skinwalker Ranch for 3 months. The wife comes home with her groceries and unpacks them and puts them away. She goes away and does something else. And then she comes back and all the groceries are back in her bag. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the least creepy poltergeist story I've ever heard. Something then steals her towel and her hairbrush. And the family post hole digger gets stolen and ends up high in the tree. So, tricksters.
I love every now and again when they use different kinds of B-roll or the dramatizations this episode had. The shape-shifting guy who was sort of, you could see him dimly through the trees, who was just wearing like a white unitard and like moving sort of funny. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to San Francisco, like a performance artist. It's like, I know that guy. That's my friend Jimmy. That dude. I'm glad he got some work.
Nice.
I could not believe the hairbrush sequence was incredible. It was so great. The hairbrush disappears. Where she find it? She finds it in the refrigerator. Yeah. And I went so granular on digging into this thing. I could not. I was as obsessed with this as anything. I was like, all right, let me see this. I had to pause, you know, because it's like the dramatization is kind of grayscale. It's a little bit shadowy at the edges. She opens the freezer door and there's a hairbrush in it. Like, you can't make that ominous. First of all. And then second of all, it's not the freezer. It's a refrigerator. You can tell by how the door is open. Like, that's the biggest freezer I've ever seen. Don't give me this shit that it's a full freezer. No, it was a refrigerator. And then there's the hairbrush kind of hanging out. And you're supposed to be scared, but it's not. And then, and this is what really bothered me, the hairbrush, they're trying to convince you that it's a freezer. So what do? They put 2 pints of ice cream next to it, right? Yeah. This is supposed to be the 90s. But the era was all wrong. It was so anachronistic because you can clearly see the ice cream has the ingredients listed on the side. Spinach, banana, avocado, ginger, dates, cardamom, apple cider vinegar, flaxseed, coconut. Okay, listen. Nobody was making ice cream with that shit in the 90s. I tried to find the ice cream. I did Google image search on it. Could not find anything. That's the biggest mystery of this show. Didn't know what the ice cream was.
Good point.
Erica, have you ever done any research on when apple cider vinegar started to be used in frozen desserts? Because I know I haven't after this.
But, you know, tonight's the night. YouTube is a great place to do research.
Well, if you can find that product, I would love to know the name of it. Because it sounds pretty good.
You've done everybody a big service through this.
that was my deep dive for the episode was, what ice cream is this?
But can you imagine like going to like a horror movie or something and it's about a poltergeist and what it really consists of is like returning groceries to their original bags and stealing stuff out of your bathroom and putting it in the refrigerator. It's just, I think the most believable thing about the stories is how sort of mundane they are.
That's just quantum kung fu, Toby. That's all
quantum
it is.
Kung fu. It's quantum something. Let's take a quick break from this discussion. And Brandon, maybe we can learn about Erica's work.
Erica, unlike some of us who spend all our time trying to figure out what brand of ice cream is in a reenactment, you're actually doing some real debunking into this wild world. Tell us, please, how you got into it.
You know what I loved? I remember picking up a book in sixth grade, or maybe fifth grade, off of the school library shelf. And it was a book about flying saucers. And I just thought, this is so freaking cool. Like, I was hooked. And then, you know, you've got E.T., and not that I'm dating myself, but I kind of am, E.T. and Close Encounters and The X-Files. You know, I mean, all of these things, like growing up and Scully and Mulder, and that was so sexy, and all of these great mysteries. And I really loved, I loved the idea of the unknown. And I always read things about it. I tried to learn as much as I could. And then in about 2013, I saw something I couldn't explain. And so I wanted to know what it was. And I joined MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and quickly learned that they were not interested in scientific study. It was just an organization that put forward ideas that weren't based in fact. And they were also mining data for Bigelow, selling data, collecting data, and then giving it to Bigelow for Lord knows what. Not to find UFOs, I can assure you. But it fascinated me. As I began to learn more and began to, like, the glimmer of all of this, it kind of wore off, and I began to see the grifters and people who were really needed help, mental help, that were being abused, I believe, because they were being told, you know, they were being abducted by space beings, and they were the chosen ones. You know, when I started to see these things at conferences and in different organizations, and seeing that there were also a lot of really good people that were involved in this because they just wanted to know more, because it should be a fun and fascinating topic. And it wasn't when I saw the darker side to it. And so for me, and then having the archive that I do here with Expanding Frontiers, which is one of the biggest UFO archives in the United States, that has one-of-a-kind research and correspondence from the 40s on. It's really wonderful. And looking through that and seeing some of the motivations, the games that were being played and things, I just went down this path that it's like, I know that we don't know everything. Is there life on other planets? There very well could be. But is it a little being with two eyes and two ears and two arms and two legs? I highly doubt it. And you know, I feel like a responsibility to make sure that people have learned from my mistakes, that people understand that you can go down all of these rabbit holes and it can have really devastating consequences if you don't understand the motivations behind certain organizations and people in the topic. And so that's my whole spiel. You know, I began doing it because I thought it was interesting. I still think it's interesting, but now I'm looking at the people and the motivations.
We've got a lot more to talk about with Erica Luke, so come back next week for that. Oh, and before I forget, if you like More Like Ancient Aliens, please give us a good review. Go on, subscribe, give us a little note, let your friends know that we're out here doing the good work, telling you what's really going on behind Ancient Aliens and behind the larger History Channel universe. Toby and I would appreciate it very much. For now, this is Brandon R. Reynolds signing off from myself and Toby Ball. This has been More Like Ancient Aliens. We'll see you next time.
Next time on More Like Ancient Aliens, Erica Lukes is back for part two of our look into the mystery of Skinwalker Ranch. We've got a perp lineup of wolves, a tunnel to another dimension visible to people with PhDs, and a guy who wonders if anyone else is hearing the voices in his head. See you next week.
More Like Ancient Aliens is produced by Grab Bag Colab, and our editor and producer is Heather Eagle Ears Wilson. Our music is by Nathan Reedy.